when I was younger, because I think what happened to me is I was reading the Bible. I used to read those sections in the Bible that we go through about Exodus 20 and God speaking on the mountain and getting out the Ten Commandments. And when Moses was at the burning bush and God talks to Moses from the burning bush. As a young person, I used to read those things and think that that was actually God the Father talking to Moses in those places. And then as you're doing the angel study, you realize, wait a minute, that's not God the Father who dwells in heaven. That's actually an angel who's talking in those places. And then you start to realize, wow, those angels, they actually could make decisions. They were empowered by God to say, look, you take care of this situation. Here's the end result that we're looking for, but you go down there and you handle it. And he gives them some latitude as to how they handle that. And I think that's fun to see. Which then backs up this idea I mentioned last night, that in the kingdom age, we will not be robots. We're not going to just be sitting around waiting there, you know, for God to tell us or Christ to say, I want you to do this or that. We are going to be entrusted with jobs to do, and we are going to have to work out how to do those jobs. And it won't be with the kind of stress that we have currently today, but because we're going to have so much help from other angels. But there's still things where we're going to have to use our minds and all this information we've gathered in this life to try to figure out how to work with people. And that's why it's important for you to go home to your CYCs and your ecclesias and be involved with people. This is where God is training us for the work of the future age. So watch the authority and the power that God gives them. If you're looking for more information on angels besides just my stuff, Trevor Mayer's got some stuff out on LavoniaTapes.com. Ron Cowie, I've talked to Ron considerably about angels back years ago. He's got a series that's out there. There's also an Australian series that he's done. He's done it a number of times. There's also one by my dad, The Angels of His Presence, and there's one by Alan Marquis. So there's more information now about angels that we have in our community. There's also a booklet I think Jim Cowie put out. Is it Jim or Ryan? I think it's Jim that put it out, but there's a little booklet on angels. So more people are actually writing about angels than ever used to and talking about them. It's important as you're going through the study of angels to understand that in the Old Testament, a lot of times it gets hidden by the use of the words that are translated in our English as God or whatever they translate them as. But just to give you an idea of how you've got to be careful going through this, if you look in Psalm 8, verses 4 and 5, famous passage that you've heard quoted a million times, what is man that you're mindful of him, the son of man that you care for him? Yet you have made him a little less than God, the RSV says. And some other versions put that in there as well, because that's the word Elohim. Now, the translators of the RSV and some other Bible versions are not near as committed to the idea of the consistency of the Old and the New Testament. The NASB was much better that way. They really believed if a passage is quoted a certain way in the New Testament, that that must tell us a little bit about which way they should lean in the Old. But some Bible versions are not like that. So they don't mind if it's different in the old versus the new. The New King James has in there, in verse 5 of Psalm 8, that you have made him a little lower than the angels and crowned him with glory and honor. And they did that even though the Hebrew word that's there is the word Elohim, which is normally translated God in our Bibles. They did that because in the New Testament, when the Apostle Paul quotes it and clearly uses it about the angels, he puts in the Hebrew word angelos, not theos. So he puts in, you have made him a little lower than the angels, and you've crowned him with glory and honor. So we have what I call Paul's authority here in Hebrews, that we definitely, when you look back at this passage here in Psalm 8, it really should have been that you have made him a little lower than the angels. And you can see as Paul's use there in Hebrews 2, Paul develops that in this life. When Jesus was born, he was born, even though he's born Son of God, he was made lower than the angels, but then he was crowned with glory and honor. And in the end, he says, let all the angels of God worship him, which is the other passage Paul brings up. So Psalm 97 in our Bibles, I think even maybe the King James Bible, I'm not really sure on this one. I know the New King James has gods in there. But in verse 7 of Psalm 97, let all be put to shame who serve carved images, who boast of idols. Worship him, all you gods. Now, is that what the King James has too? Something about gods? What does it put in there? Gods, right? Yeah. But see, that's actually the passage that's quoted in Hebrews 1 and verse 6 when Paul says, when he again brings the firstborn into the world, he says, let all the angels of God worship him. So, and by the way, that word again right there in your King James Bible, those of you that are, we have a lot of King James users here, so it's good to know sometimes they put that again in the wrong place. They put it back here. They just thought Paul was saying, oh, and again, here's another verse to back it up. But that's not what he says. Paul is saying, but when he again brings the firstborn into the world. So when would that be? His birth or his resurrection? Resurrection. See, that? So Paul's trying to develop the idea that when Jesus was first born, then it was all the angels of God, you know, that they were being asked in this case, that he was made a little lower than the angels. But when he brings the firstborn again into the world, now it's let all the angels of God worship him, because he's been given the name above every name, and all principalities and powers and authorities, including angels, have been subject to Jesus Christ. So that word Elohim in the Old Testament a lot of times actually refers to angels. We just don't realize it, the mighty ones. So look at some examples of how you rethink some of the things in the Old Testament that we've read for years. In Exodus 3, with Moses, some of you probably did a Moses study in kids camp years ago, and you got all these things down in Sunday school. But when the angel of the Lord appeared to him in the flame of fire in the midst of the bush, Moses looks, right? And Moses, in verse 3, turns aside and he sees the sight. And then in verse 4, when the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush. Now, I still remember reading that as a kid and thinking that was God the Father from heaven who somehow came down to the bush and called to Moses and said, Moses, Moses, here. And he said, here I am. So as you're reading through Exodus 3, what happens? He says, take your sandals off your feet. In verse 6, he said, I am the God of your father. And I think this is what convinced me. This was like the God. You know, he said, this person talking with Moses actually said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And then Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. Who else did that in our studies this week? Who thought they were going to die because they'd seen God? Manoah, right? I mean, it's just the reaction people have when they see these angels. Right, and this is how he, first of all, this is his initial reaction. He thinks he's going to end up being in trouble because he somehow looked at God, and we know that you can't look at God and live. So this obviously isn't God the Father in this case. And as you're going through this, you see that this person says, the Lord said, I have surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt. I've heard their cry because of their taskmasters and know their sorrow. So I have come down to deliver them. Now, anytime you see that in the Bible, in the Old Testament, that they come down, is that really God the Father leaving heaven, coming here to earth? No. He's sending a representative. And in this case, it's an angel who's going to show up, who's going to talk to Moses. The angel is there in the burning bush, and the angel speaks with the authority of God. That's what he does. He talks like he's God. You know, I am the God of your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You know, I've seen the oppression of my people. I've heard their cry. So he's talking as though he is God, even though it's actually an angel, and he's come down to deliver them. So in Exodus 19, you know, you get to the point where Moses brings the people out of Egypt. He takes them to this very mountain where he had seen the burning bush, and he brings the people there to meet with God on the mountain. So they come up in verse 17 to meet with God, and they stand at the foot of the mountain. And Mount Sinai is completely covered in smoke because the Lord descended upon it in fire. Its smoke ascended like the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked greatly. And you get the feeling like God's really there on the mountain. But really, it isn't God. Of course, he dwells in heaven, and no man can see him, and he doesn't literally come down to earth. So as you go through this in Exodus 20, when the Ten Commandments are given, God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. In Acts chapter 7, Stephen clarifies this and says, hey, folks, we all know this is common knowledge amongst Jews that when it says that, that's not actually God the Father. That's an angel who's talking to Stephen or talking to Moses. And so in verse 38 of Acts 7, which is a good cross reference to have in your margin somewhere, he says, this is he, when he's talking about Moses here, who is in the congregation in the wilderness with the angel who spoke to him on Mount Sinai and with our fathers. So this is the angel who then thundered out the Ten Commandments, who was there speaking to him, just like it had said in Exodus chapter 3, that an angel of the Lord had appeared in the burning bush. So what you discover from this is that, wow, I had to rethink how I read the Old Testament. All these stories that talk about God appearing to people and God talking to people, that's not actually God in heaven. That's actually an angel who gets sent as a representative to deliver a message to these people. So, and Stephen says it was the angel who spoke to him in Mount Sinai. Now, in our Judges study, I don't know whether you went back and read Judges chapter 2, but this is the story when the angel recounts with the people all the things that he'd done for them to bring them out of Egypt, to take them into the promised land. And so the angel of the Lord came up in Judges 2 at verse 1 from Gilgal to Bochim and said, I led you up from Egypt and brought you to the land which I swore to your fathers, and I said, I will never break my covenant with you. Now, this is an angel talking at this point. Now, did an angel really lead them up from Egypt? Did he? Did an angel lead them? Yes. So it's not like this isn't wrong. This angel was probably Michael, and he literally had led them up out of Egypt. He'd done all those miraculous plagues with them. This was the angel, and he told them, don't make covenants with the inhabitants of the land in verse 2. And therefore I said in verse 3, I will not drive them out before you, but they're going to be thorns in your side. And verse 4, there it is again. So it was when the angel of the Lord spoke these words to all the children of Israel, the people lifted up their voices and they wept. So they realized when an angel was talking to them that the angel is speaking as though he were God. He has the authority and the commission of God to come and talk to people. And this is what God empowers his angels to do. They don't just become members of his family. They become people who he has empowered. He trusts them to deliver his message. These are what that Psalm said last night. These are beings that do his word. They hearken unto the voice of his word, and he can trust them to work these situations out. And so he sends them out on missions. That's what he does. So you go back to Genesis 3. This is another one I had to rethink, because when I was growing up, I used to think that when Adam and Eve heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden, I used to think, oh, somehow that's God walking in the garden. And I really, as a younger kid, had not really figured this out. But here he is in the cool of the day. Adam and his wife, they hid themselves from the presence of the Lord God among the trees of the garden. And we sort of laugh at that and say, well, how can anybody hide themselves from the presence of God, right? But when you understand this was an angel, and they're hiding themselves from an angel, then it is a little bit different. Even though the angels did know they were there, they actually thought they could hide from this angel. Because you're going to find out that angels don't have all the powers of God. They're not omnipresent. They're not all-knowing like God is. So they actually have to show up places to find out what's happening. God doesn't have to do that. They do. So the Lord God called to Adam and said, where are you? And he said, well, I heard your voice in the garden. I was afraid because I was naked and I hid myself. Because they thought they could hide from the angels. Now, sometimes I do this series in 6 classes, but this year we're getting it in 5. So I threw in some stuff from Zechariah because I don't want you to miss Zechariah, because of all places in the Bible, this probably has the most interactions of angels, and it shows you the kind of authority they have and yet the limits to their authority as well. Now, I don't know how many of you have ever, anybody studied Zechariah? It's not on the top hit list of most Christadelphians of what to study. I happen to like Zechariah because I found when I was reading about it, our brethren are so confused about what views they have on Zechariah of past and versus future that I found it was fascinating to try to figure out what it was. As you go through our writings, the Christadelphian writings, you're going to find, like if you look at Brother Mansfield's writings or different ones, that they take some of Zechariah and they say, oh, this applied in the past. And then they take the next set of verses and say, oh, this is all future. And that wasn't happy with me. It wasn't satisfied. Finally, I talked to John Martin one time about it, and he said, oh, no, this whole thing had an historical application. You just got to look carefully to figure out where it is. And like prophecy, it does. It has an historical application to the time period in which it was written, as well as future applications. And that made a lot more sense to me. So in Zechariah 1, this is one of the first visions that he sees. Zechariah sees seven night visions in one night, and it's all to convince them, to convince Zechariah and the people. God gives him this so that he can go talk to the people and say, hey, it's time to get going again. Let's build the temple. You quit working on it. You thought you were supposed to quit. We got to get going. We got to finish this temple. They've been working on it for 16 years, and then they quit. And in four more years, they get it done. So they were getting close. So in Zechariah 1, what happens? You see this man riding on a red horse. That's actually, this is the background for the four horsemen of Revelation. A lot of Revelation actually comes out of Zechariah's stories. So the man riding on the red horse, and it stands among the myrtle trees in the hollow, and behind him are horses red, sorrel, and white. So how many horses we got? Probably four, right? Then we got the red one, and then we got the red, the sorrel, and the white that were there. So I said, my Lord, what are these? So the angel who talked with me said to me, I'll show you what they are. So you got to picture this. You got this myrtle tree out there, and there's a man standing there in the myrtle trees, and he's got a red horse with him. And there's three other horses back here ridden by others, which are all angels in this case. And they show up and they talk to the one who's standing at the myrtle trees. And then there's this other angel over here. And who's he talking with? Zechariah. All right. So you've actually got what? At least five angels here all at one time interacting into how they work. That's why I like Zechariah's stories. So the man who stood among the myrtle trees answered and said, these are the ones whom the Lord has sent to walk to and fro throughout the earth. Walk to and fro throughout the earth. I mean, they've been sent on missions to accomplish something, and now they are reporting back. That's what they accomplish what they were sent to do, and they're coming back and reporting to another angel to let them know that we've accomplished what we were supposed to do. And what they were supposed to do, to understand the history, is that during the time period of building the temple, there had arisen a king who, we think today at least, that he either killed off the previous king, Cambyses, or when King Cambyses died, he killed his descendants, and this guy claimed to be the next ruler. He was an imposter, and he took over the Persian Empire for about 7 to 9 months. But he's a fake, so a lot of people in history call him the pseudo-Smyrtus guy. And what had happened at that time is that in the midst of trying to get the temple built, this guy had come along, and he's the one in Ezra 4 who made them all stop working on the temple because he was spooked by the letter that if you let these Jews continue working, they're going to rebel. And he just sends the army and says, you got to quit working on this temple. So they did. After 16 years, they quit for a period of months. And then God sends Zechariah and he sends Haggai to convince the people that you got to get going again. You got to keep building. And during that period, during that political period, because this guy was an imposter and he was spooked out about how to rule, he didn't do a very good job of ruling the empire, and outskirts of the empire began to rebel. And therefore, it wasn't a good time to finish building the temple. So these angels were sent out on a mission to bring the kingdom back under stability so that the next king who finally eliminated this fake guy, the one who we call Darius or Darius the Persian, he comes along and he says, let him finish the job, and all you guys that caused trouble, you pay for it. That's what in Ezra chapter 5 and 6 that actually shows up. So this is the background to what these angels were talking about. So Cyrus had built, during the time of Cyrus at least, he's the one that gave them permission to go back and build the temple, and they had worked in 6 years. Then after him, Cyrus dies and Cambyses takes over. And then this fellow that some historians call Gomedes, others call him a fake Smyrtus because he claimed to be a Smyrtus, a descendant of Cambyses, he took over for about 7 months, and then God overthrows him and puts in Darius, the same King Darius that's in the book of Daniel, and he's the one who allowed them to finish building the temple. And the whole thing took about 20 years, the whole time for building up the temple, because they finished in the sixth year of Darius. So that's the background to this. And if those of you that like timelines like I do, I created a timeline for this whole period to keep it straight. And that was the only way I could quickly reference it in my years to figure out what was actually going on. But the temple starts back here around 536 in Cyrus's time, then Cambyses, then the fake guy takes over for about 7 months. And then in the sixth year of Darius, the temple's finished and dedicated. So Haggai and Zechariah, they start up about here, which is probably, I think it's the second year of Darius, and then the temple's finished in the sixth year. So these angels that are showing up here, they're angels that are involved in the getting this temple built. That actually is a line of the family line of the Persians showing you how that worked, but don't worry about that now. So back to Zechariah 1. So here we've got these angels that have shown up, the four angels that came back on the horses, and they've done their job. They brought the kingdom back under its stability, and they report back, and they say, God, we finished the mission. And so, in verse 11, they answered the angel of the Lord who stood amongst the myrtle trees, and they said, we've walked to and fro throughout the earth, and behold, all the earth is resting quietly. They had accomplished their job. So then, the angel of the Lord answers and says, now, who's he talking to? Who's the angel talking to? In verse 12, the angel of the Lord answered and said, O Lord of hosts, who's that? Here's an angel talking to God. I think in this case, this is an angel talking to God. O Lord of hosts, how long will you not have mercy on Jerusalem and on the cities of Judah, of which you were angry these 70 years? It's been 70 years, the 70-year captivity, and it should be over, and the temple should be getting finished. And the Lord answered the angel who talked with me with comforting words, because he realizes it's going to be about over. It's the God's message through Zechariah is going to be, look, guys, get back building the temple, get back to work. I'll give you protection from the Persians. In fact, they had no idea that they were not only going to get protection, they were going to get money to build the temple. And all their enemies all around, all the Samaritans are told, you leave them alone and let them finish. It was like the best thing you could ever imagine was going to come out of all of this if they get back to work. And they did. And so the angel gave them comforting words. And then the angel who spoke with me said to me, proclaim, saying, thus says the Lord of hosts, I am zealous for Jerusalem and for Zion with great zeal. And you get this promise that he's going to finish it. And then Zechariah gets the next vision at the end of chapter 1 about the four carpenters, right? And the four carpenters. And, you know, some people think that's all future. But when you look at it at the time, you see that what that was is God was trying to tell them, these are carpenters. Carpenters, what are they going to do? What are these carpenters going to do at the end of chapter 1? They're going to wipe out all these horns. God's going to use these builders of the temple, these fellows that were, I'm going to use you guys, and you are going to overpower all these powers that you think are going to, that have been holding up against you and preventing you from finishing the work. You're going to get the job done. It's interesting to note, though, the fact that this angel of the Lord answered and said, Lord of hosts, how long will you not have mercy on Jerusalem? That shows you that the angels are limited in their timeline. They don't have the full timeline. They know only what they need to know to get their job done. But you're going to see many times where angels are not aware of the full timeline. So when you make it to the kingdom, don't think that Christ is just going to tell you everything about the kingdom age and you're going to have the timeline all figured out at once. It doesn't work like that. They get shown enough information to accomplish their job, but there's things that God withholds from them and keeps them guessing. And you can imagine how they talk to each other. And they try to figure out, what do you think this is going to be? How's this going to work out? Things into which angels long to look, right? I mean, that's the New Testament reference. They were excited about these things. They're finally seeing things happen that they've been waiting for years to figure out. How is this actually going to be accomplished? And that's what these angels were doing right here. So then in chapter 2, you see another one. In chapter 2, you see this vision. He sees, this is another vision he sees now, the third one. He sees a vision of a man with a measuring line in his hand. So he's got a measuring line to measure the city of Jerusalem. And so I said to him, where are you going? And he says, to measure Jerusalem, to see what is its width and its length. And then the angel who talked with thee was going out. And another angel was coming out to meet him. So you get this interaction of angels in Zechariah that you don't see a whole lot elsewhere in the Bible. So the angel's talking with me, and he's now going to go out, and another angel's coming out to meet him, and this other angel says to the angel that had been talking to Zechariah, he says, hey, go and speak to this young man and tell him Jerusalem's going to be inhabited as towns without walls because of the multitude of the men and the livestock in it. This is the blessing God's going to bring to Jerusalem. So do you really need to worry about measuring the walls and building the walls up right now and getting the walls finished? No, you don't need to worry about those walls. Because back in Ezra, when they were building right now, there were people who were worried, who were saying at the time when Zechariah and Haggai were trying to get them back to work on the temple, they were saying, oh no, forget the temple. We got to build the walls. We got to get those walls built so the Persians don't come in again and make us shut down like this. We got to get the walls built first. And this vision was to convince them that, wait a minute, you don't have to worry about the walls. You know, because God says in the next couple of verses, he says, I'm going to be a wall of fire around you to protect you. Now, if you ever read Brother Mansfield's notes on Zechariah, I think he mistakenly applied this to, he thought the measuring line was to destroy Jerusalem. And this is the kind of confusion that I ran into as a young person trying to figure out Zechariah, because he thought the measuring line was for destruction and didn't realize that the measuring line was to measure the city to build the walls. And then he gets told, forget the walls. God will protect you. What you got to do is finish the temple. But look at the interaction of the angels, how they work with one another. One angel runs out, talks to another angel, says, go do this job. You never find angels responding to another one and saying, why do I have to do that? They don't do that. Or why don't you get somebody else to do it? Or I'm too busy. Or I'm too tired. Play too much volleyball today. I want to do that. You don't find angels doing that. What you see amongst the angels is a group of beings who are so cooperative, it's like utopian world of how they get along. And if you've ever been frustrated by life in ecclesial life or your job or your whatever, working with committees of people who don't ever seem to be able to put it all together and get along, this is when it finally all comes to fruition, that this is what God is offering you. He's offering you the opportunity to work with beings in the kingdom age and beyond who all get along, they all work for God, and they all have the goal of doing God's will in mind. It will be the greatest time we've ever lived. And this is what's held out for you, is the hope of being a part of the family of God. It's really great to see. You'll also notice that some angels have more authority than others. We're not going to be all equal in the kingdom in terms of authority levels. It's going to depend on what we're able to handle. God will only give us what we're able to handle. And some people are being trained now to handle more than others. And that's okay. You're going to have eternity to grow. And so they're not worried about their own position, these angels. They're not worried about how they fit into the hierarchy of the group. What they're all there for is getting the job done, all to the glory of God. These are the people God invites into his family. And this is the opportunity now. When you're here at camp, when you go home next week, when you go to school, when you get your jobs, this is when you practice all these things about being a member of God's family. In Zechariah 3, this one's interesting because it shows up in the New Testament. This is when Joshua, who's the high priest at the time, this is not Joshua who led the people in the land. I think some versions maybe call him Joshua. I'm not really sure. But anyway, some of them call him Joshua, some call him Joshua. But this would be the man who should have been the high priest. Now, why couldn't he operate as high priest right now? There's no temple, right? So he's waiting for the temple to be built. Well, while he's waiting for the temple to be built, Joshua doesn't just sit on the sidelines and say, hey guys, build me a temple so I can be high priest and do all these things for you. He's out there working on the temple. He's all dirty and filthy because he's trying to get the temple built. And he's wondering if it's ever going to get done because the people, they gave up. They lacked the faith to continue the job. And when the Persian army came, they shut it down. And Joshua's worried that he'll never see the temple built. And Zechariah chapter 3 is all about the fact God promises him, Joshua, it's going to get done in your lifetime, and we're going to change your clothes, and you are going to operate as high priest. It's going to happen in your day. And of course, John Thomas said, like, wow, this is definitely an application to Christ as well. And so we've got a lot of writings on that, but it's important to realize it had an application at the time. So he sees Joshua the high priest standing before the angel of the Lord, who is Michael, and we know that from Jude 9. And Satan is there. So you've got Joshua standing here and Satan standing here, and they're standing before the angel, before the Lord, and Satan is there to oppose them. And the Lord says to Satan, in this case, the Lord rebuke you, Satan. The Lord who has chosen Jerusalem rebuke you. Now, that's confusing because the Lord said to Satan, the Lord rebuke you. Who actually spoke to Satan? Was that God in heaven or was that the angel? That doesn't come across real clear in that version there. But when you look at Jude 9, you find out that that Lord said to Satan is actually the angel. So here is an angel standing there on behalf of the people, and he's got all this power to work God's will. And here is Joshua the high priest standing there before the angel of the Lord. Satan's there to oppose him, and the Lord says to Satan, what he says to Satan in this case is, "The Lord rebuke you." Now, here's an angel right here who's got all the authority to just shut the whole thing down. He could call fire from heaven. He could call legions of angels and just totally overthrow the Samaritans and wipe them out. He could. But what does he do? When the Lord's standing there and these people were there opposing the Jews, do the angels sit there and curse them and chew them out? Do they revile them? Do they treat them the way we might treat them? Or do they simply say, "God, will you take care of this?" And what Jude does with this story, young people, is it's the only time I know of in the Bible where somebody takes a story about an angel and how the angel behaves, and Jude says, you know what? That's telling us that's the way we should behave. When people mistreat us, when people say things about us that aren't true, when they rebuke us, when they revile us, you don't have to yell at them. You don't have to scream at them. You don't have to take vengeance on them. You don't have to do all those things. You can do the same thing Jesus did. You can just let God handle it. The Lord rebuke you is what this angel says right there. The Lord rebuke you, Satan. And Joshua was standing there before the angel of the Lord. And so the angel says in verse 4, he spoke to those who stood before him, "Take away these filthy clothes," because God had removed his iniquity from him and he's going to clothe them with rich robes. So in the Old Testament story, Joshua was being told, get rid of your filthy garments because we're going to finish this temple. You're going to put on your high priestly garments and you're going to operate as high priest. And they put a clean turban on his head and the angel of the Lord stood by. Now, look at what Jude does with this, just so you can see the interaction of these two stories. In Jude verse 8, Jude is talking about people that were influencing ecclesial life. They were people that came into the ecclesia, but they didn't come in to help. They came in just to cause problems, like the Samaritans had back there in Ezra. And they came in and they said things about people that weren't true. They would have caused trouble in the ecclesia. They were causing all kinds of problems. And he says, likewise, these dreamers, they defile the flesh, they reject authority, they speak evil of dignitaries. And then he brings up this story from Zechariah, and he says, yet Michael the archangel, in contending with the devil, that would have been the Satan back there, when he disputed about the body of Moses, which is probably the Israelite community there, he dared not bring against him a reviling accusation, but he simply said, "The Lord rebuke you." But not these people. They don't do that. They just rattle off all kinds of stuff, probably all kinds of curses and all kinds of foul words about the opposition. And Jude is trying to convince the believers, don't act like that. That's not the way angels behave, even though they have more authority and more power than any of us. They don't behave like that, and neither should we. I find that fascinating that somebody would use the behavior of a powerful angel as an exhortation to us about how we should behave in dealing with people in ecclesial life. I mean, you think about that in arranging meetings, ecclesial business meetings. You think about this in CYC meetings that you have. This is a warning that when we get upset about an issue and we have a problem with it, we can't just become a different person. The angels who have so much more power than we do, they don't behave like that. They simply let God take care of the issue and they let God respond. And that's what we should do. We should pray about it. But we don't belittle people. We don't mistreat people. We don't become a very nasty person at meetings, because that's not how God's family members behave. They don't do that. They simply show the character of God. So this angel of the Lord admonished Joshua in verse 6 back in Zechariah. And he said, look, if you walk in my ways, and you keep up my commands and you judge my house, I'll give you charge over my courts and I'll give you places to walk among these who stand here, amongst these angels. That's what Joshua was being promised. And then he talks about the stone that he had in this case here, and the bringing forth of I'm going to bring forth my servant, the branch, which probably back then, in this case, was probably referring to Zechariah in this case. It would have been Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel would have been the king. He should have been the king at this time of the community, but he would have been their governor. And Jeshua would be the priest. So the two of them represented the roles of the king and the priest, the governor and the priest at that time. But God used Zerubbabel as an example of he was bringing forth his servant, the branch, which was Zerubbabel back then, and it would have been the Lord Jesus Christ in the future application. And he's got this stone sitting there, and the stone that's laid before Joshua, upon the stone are seven eyes. Now, if you go back and look at how they built temples back then, and they built big buildings, what the builders would do as they were putting together the building is they would always be looking at stones that they could use for the final capstone. It had to be a special stone. It was the last one that went up there, and the stone would go up there in the top, like at the peak right here, and it would sit right at the top, and all the force would come down, but it had to be the right shape and the right weight in order to give the building the stability from the top down. It calls it the capstone. And what's happening is you would set aside as your building, which the stone you think is going to be the best one. This is not the cornerstone. That would have already been laid. This is going to be the capstone. And if you found a better one as you're working, then you would replace it. And what he says is there are seven eyes, and they're not in the stone. The seven eyes are looking at the stone, and they're waiting for the day when the stone will go up. These seven eyes, and God's promising that they're going to get the job done. And these seven eyes are going to end up being the angels in this case. They were representing the angels that were there that would make sure that this got done. So in Zechariah 4, the angel who talked with me came back and he wakes him up again, and we get another vision. This one in chapter 4 is all about Zerubbabel. The first one in chapter 3 was about Joshua the high priest promising him he's going to get his clothes changed and he will be there when this temple is finished operating as high priest. Zechariah 4 is going to be about Zerubbabel promising him, look, governor, you are still going to be around. The temple is going to be finished in your days, and you will operate as governor of the land with the temple finished. So in chapter 4, he wakes him up, and he says, what do you see? And he sees a lampstand of solid gold with bowl on top of it. So it's got seven lamps up in there in this lampstand. And then there's an olive tree over here, and there's an olive tree over here with pipes going from the olive tree right into the bowl, feeding it so that it can put out light and the lamps can work. And what he's seeing in a vision in this case is, I really believe, is that the two olive trees that show up like in Revelation 11 again, these two olive trees were Joshua and Zerubbabel, the governor and the high priest. And God was promising to use them in order to bring the light of the ecclesia back to work, and the operation of the temple was going to get done. And his promise is it will get done, and you will be there helping this out. And so the angel talked with him, and he says to him, well, what are these, my Lord? And the angel who talked with me answered and said, well, don't you know what these are? And to this day, we argue about what they are, because it isn't near as clear as you hope it would be. But in this case, I think it's connected with the two witnesses of Revelation 11. That's the basis of Revelation 11, is building off of this story, giving it a different application. They were the witnesses of the time. But in Zechariah 4, right, don't get hung up on the specifics, because I want you to see the angel's work here. So he says to him in verse 6, this is the word of the Lord to Zerubbabel, not by might nor by power, but by my spirit. You don't need an army. You don't need walls. You don't need all these things. God's going to accomplish this through his spirit, says the Lord, through the work of the angels. And you see that big mountain in front of you, Zerubbabel? See that huge mountain of the Persian army that you don't think you can build, you can't get by? It's going to become a plain. And he shall bring forth the capstone. So there's the last stone. The promise is you're going to put the capstone up, Zechariah. You're going to see it go up with shouts of grace, grace to it. Because in the end, they will all realize it was only by the grace of God that it ever got done. And you can see the flowing terminology that applies into the life of Christ and beyond. So this definitely has another application, but it certainly had an application to the people of this time. And he says specifically to Zerubbabel right here, the hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of this temple. His hands shall also finish it. And then you will know that the Lord of hosts has sent me to you. Here's the angel promising him that, look, it, when this happens and you finally see that capstone go up, you're going to know that all these things that I've told you really were true. Now, look at verse 10. This is the one I find the most impressive. For who has despised the day of small things? Now, if you ever do a study of Haggai and Zechariah and you link them together, what you find is that during the 16 years they were working on the temple and they were building the temple, you remember back in the story of Ezra when they laid the foundation? You remember any of those stories when you did your Ezra studies? When they laid the foundation and they finally got the foundations finished, what was the response of the people? Some of them were crying and some of them were rejoicing. There were two groups of people. Probably the older ones were crying. And why were they crying? Do you remember why?
Because they had seen Solomon's temple.
They had seen the original temple and they looked at what they're going to build now and they're just crying, this is no good. This is terrible. And they're crying about the fact that this is almost like a waste. And they grew to despise the day of small things. And look at the message to these people. You know, in terms of our work in ecclesias and in CYCs, who's despised the day of small things? These seven, the seven eyes that are on that stone, see, here they come up again. These angels rejoice to see the plumb line and the hand of Zerubbabel, and they're the eyes of the Lord, which scan to and fro throughout the whole earth, which goes right back to chapter 1 of those angels that have been out going through the earth, to and fro throughout the earth. These seven eyes on the capstone couldn't wait for the day when that stone went up. And you think this is a day of small things? The angels are thrilled about the work getting done. They're excited because they're not so focused on the building, but on what's happening to the characters that are building the building. That's what they're looking at. They saw the project is an opportunity to develop spiritual lives in people, to challenge people to live by faith. And the angels watch the capstone go up and they realize, look at what these people accomplished by faith. And they had helped to do that in those human people. This is how excited angels get about their work. They rejoice when sometimes we think it's sort of worthless, not worth doing. And they're looking at it from a whole different perspective. They get excited about these projects God sends them on, and they can't wait to see the project accomplished. Now, one of the things you find out about angels is they certainly are very limited sometimes in what they know. There's other times they show up and they seem to know everything, but they really don't, as we already saw in one case before tonight. But remember Matthew 24, when the disciples asked Jesus about the end times, and he told them of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. I think one of the other Gospels actually says, not even the Son. So only the Father had known that day that he had fixed by his own authority, and he had not yet revealed it to the angels. I find that really interesting because if that's the case, and the angels already had the entire Old Testament, can you figure out the day that Christ returns from the Old Testament? Probably not, or the angels would have figured it out. Nobody knew. They still didn't know at that point. Now, when Jesus gave the revelation, that might be a little different story, but at least when you're going through Daniel and all the Old Testament prophecies, I don't think you're going to find in Daniel anywhere where you're going to figure out the day in which Christ returns, as hard as you want to look. Even the angels hadn't figured it out. All right, 1 Peter 1 and verse 12, when he's talking about the prophets, to them it was revealed. And not to themselves, but to us, they were ministering the things which have now been reported to you through those who have preached the gospel to you by the Holy Spirit sent from heaven, things which angels desire to look into. That helps us understand that in the kingdom age, God isn't going to just give us all knowledge. When you're resurrected from the dead, you don't get that. You get enough to do the jobs that we're assigned to do. But there are things that God and Christ will withhold in their own authority about events of the future, and they don't tell them everything. Even though the angels try to figure those things out, they really don't know them all. In fact, I really think from a personal level that we all have angels working with us personally. I think, Micah, you've got one working with you, and I think you've got one working with you and you, and we've all got angels that are working in our lives, and they know us really well. Do you think they know whether we're going to make it? Now think about that. Suppose you were in the kingdom and you got a sign, right? So Caleb, you get assigned to work with this mortal, you know, this fella here, Tom. And that's your job. You're going to work with Tom. I want you to work with Tom, and I want you to develop him and try your hardest to bring him, you know, develop faith in him, and so I can immortalize him and make him part of the family, but he ain't going to make it. Now, how would you feel? You think you're really going to try very hard with Tom? It would be pretty depressing, wouldn't it? But see, those are the kind of things you think through about our work in the kingdom. There will be things we don't know. And it's good we don't know, because just in our life now, it's good that we don't know about our own kids and about our ecclesial members, because we would get depressed and we would quit. And so God is going to allow us to know certain things, but there's going to be a bunch of other things that we don't know. Our knowledge will be limited, just like these angels. I think you find that some angels, as we looked at in Zechariah, some are above others, because in Joshua 5, remember the angel that showed up when you did your Joshua studies, and he's talking to Joshua. And he says, Joshua says, well, whose side are you on? And the angel looks at Joshua like, what are you talking about? And no, I've come as commander of the army of the Lord. And Joshua falls on his face at that point and realizes he's talking to an angel. But, you know, some angels are commanders of the army, and others are just members of the army. And so that's why you've got things like in Jude 1 that Michael is an archangel. And there are other angels which are not archangels. So angels are going to have different rankings, and we will have different rankings too. So if you're the kind of person that in this life is all worried about your ranking in CYC and your ranking in the ecclesia and your ranking everywhere, you've got to knock this out of yourself. We can't be like this. But those are not the people that get invited to join God's family. You have to be somebody who's willing to cooperate as a team player and a member who does what's needed to be done for the sake of the group. That's the kind of people we have to be. That's what these angels are like. They've already practiced and they've learned how to do it. And this is our time to practice now in our CYCs, in our families, in our ecclesias, at our jobs, at our schools. You practice these things so God will invite you into his family. And that's okay. We don't have to be top dog. We just have to be able to be a part of the project. You look in Daniel chapter 10. This one you know about when Gabriel was going to talk to Daniel. Gabriel was trying to get away from the prince of Persia. I think what was happening at this point is the Persians were progressing too fast, and they were going to overthrow the Babylonians too soon. And so Gabriel had been assigned to hold back the prince of Persia so that the Persians didn't get there too soon, and God's plan wouldn't happen at the right time. So he's holding back the king of Persia, but he got left alone there with the king of Persia, and he couldn't leave until he got Michael, one of the chief princes, to come and help me. And then Gabriel could go talk to Daniel. So that shows you some of the limits of angels. We tend to think of them as that, oh, no problem, they can just zap things and get it done. There's limits to how they can get stuff done. There are parameters in which they are working. And in this case, the king of Persia, in this case, was causing a problem for which they had to get some help. And Gabriel needed some help in the hand of Michael. And so human people can frustrate the work of angels. And one thing you don't want to do is frustrate your own angel. Your angel is trying every day, full time, every day, to make it to the kingdom. He wants you to be there. They want you to make it. And we want to go home and not frustrate our angels. Don't work against them. Don't work against another person's angel by mistreating other people, because they have angels working with them as well. And we end up just frustrating their work when we don't realize what's actually happening behind the scenes. Yeah, one of the great things I want to finish up with today is Psalm 89. This one I found really fascinating. I think it helped that I was using the RSV as a young person, but in Psalm 89, you get this picture of how it all works in the divine counsel. Let the heavens praise thy wonders, O Lord, thy faithfulness in the assembly of the holy ones. So he sees there's this assembly in heaven of the holy ones. This is not the saints. This is not the people on earth. This is not us. This is a heavenly council where angels are out there sitting around the throne, and God talks with his angels. For who in the skies can be compared with the Lord? Who among the heavenly beings is like the Lord? So he's talking about the heavenly beings. A God feared in the council of the holy ones, great and terrible about all that are around him. And what he pictures in Psalm 89 is God on a throne, And all around him are angels. And you can imagine God having discussions with the angels about what the plan is for today, what God wants to accomplish for today, some project that he has going about what he wants them to do. Probably those angels that rode out on the horses and took care of bringing the Persian government under control had been there at the divine council, and they had been told what they were supposed to do. This is how it works in God's heavenly council. This is how he runs it. And if you want to see a case of where this actually happens in practice, I think one of the greatest ones is 1 Kings 22. Do you remember the story of Jehoshaphat when he goes up there to try to bring peace with Ahab? Remember that story? And all it does is cause problems. Ahab waits until Jehoshaphat's there in front of all the people. And what does he say to Jehoshaphat? What does he say to him? He invites them to take part in a war. And what did he invite them to fight? Remember that story? He invites them to fight against the Syrians because the Syrians had come down from the north and had taken some of the cities of the northern kingdom. And so Ahab waits until Jehoshaphat's there in front of all the people and he says, hey, what do you think? Why don't you come and help me fight this war against the Syrians and take back my cities? And what's Jehoshaphat going to say? Like, no, in front of all those people, I'm not going to help you out. And so he says, oh, okay. And then he says, well, maybe we ought to, Jehoshaphat says, we really ought to ask the prophets what they think. And Ahab calls in all his 450 prophets, right, and all these prophets of Baal. And what do? It's like being at a school, what I compare it to is a school pep assembly, where they do all these things, they work out things, and they act like how we're going to destroy the other team in the game today. I used to have to watch that at my school. And they'd act out all these things about how our basketball team's going to destroy the other guys. And so what do these guys do? They put on horns and they say, hey, this is the way we're going to beat the Syrians. And they act out all these things and they get the people all rallied up. And Jehoshaphat's watching all this and he says, wait a minute, Ahab, isn't there a prophet of Yahweh here? Don't you have any prophets of Yahweh? And Ahab says, oh, yeah, I got this one guy, right? One Micaiah. Yeah, I got him. But he never says anything good about me. So why do we want him? And Joshua says, yeah, we really should ask the prophet of Yahweh. Well, where is he? He's in prison. So, hey, go get him out of prison. Clean him up and bring him out here. So you go to get him out of prison. And you can imagine the discussion going on. You go talk to him. You get him cleaned up. And you tell him all the way along. You say, hey, look, Micaiah, look, everybody's in there. The pep assembly's going. We're all pumped up. We're ready to go. Don't wreck it. And Micaiah comes in. And what does he say? He says, look, he first of all, he says, you know, oh, sure, go ahead and fight and you're going to win. And Joshua said, so, you know, even Ahab, they all realize he's being sarcastic. And he says, wait a minute, you know, come on, tell us the truth. Look at the truth. Micaiah said, therefore, hear the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne and the host of heaven standing by. Here's the divine counsel on his right hand and on his left. And the Lord said, who will persuade Ahab to go up that he may fall at Ramoth-Gilead? And one spirit spake in one manner, and another spoke in that. Now, you see how this works? God gets the angels together, and he says, okay, here's the job today. The game plan today is we're going to cause Ahab to fall at Ramoth and Gilead. How do you think we should do it? Now, isn't that awesome that God would inquire of the angels about how do you think we should do this? They're not robots. God uses what they've learned to try to figure out and let them operate in such a way that they're challenged. What do you think we should do? So you come forward and say one thing, you come forward and say something else, and they throw out the ideas on the table. See, this is how teams work and real committees operate. God sets out the plan, everybody puts in their input, they throw it out on the table, and finally somebody says, hey, you know what? I'll be a lying spirit in the mouth of its prophets, and I'll fool them. And God says, that's it, Josh. You got it. Go and do it. And that's what Micaiah said. This is how he saw it operating. And a spirit came forward and stood before the Lord and said, I will persuade him. And the Lord said, in what way? And he said, I will go out and be a lying spirit in the mouth of all his prophets. And the Lord said, you shall persuade him and also prevail. Go out and do so. Therefore, look, the Lord has put a lying spirit in the mouth of all these prophets of yours. Now, you see how that works? The Lord has put the lying spirit in the mouth, but how did it happen? It was through the work of the angels. This is how God's spirit operates in a big way in our world still today. So it's fun to watch this and realize this is what you have been invited to. You're not invited to a kingdom in which you just sit there as a couch potato and you watch all these things taking place and you have a nice, peaceful life with no challenges and all that. That is not what our real vision of the kingdom is. Our vision of the kingdom is to join the angels in their work. Take over for them and their jobs right now. This is what God has invited you to, and it will be fun, it will be challenging, it will be exciting, and it will be in some ways frustrating, but balanced with the fact that we understand God's in control, and in the end, it's all going to work out. All things are going to work together for good to those who love God and are called according to his purpose. It will be the most awesome time you could ever imagine, and that's what you've been invited to do, young people. All you got to do is take up the invitation and go for it. So we'll leave it at that.